I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. The fifth annual remembrance of this city's native son and jazz great, the Charlie Parker Celebration, is underway. You can catch any number of performances between now and next Saturday. Tevan Pennicott, the David Bassi Trio, and Lonnie McFadden, to name a few. But today, a different way to realize jazz, with a sneak peek at the tour that will take you to the places where jazz was made and played. But first, we had Mayor James at the start of this week to talk about his proposed sales tax to fund pre-K education. Now, those with concerns about the tax, the process, and the monitoring of pre-K in Kansas City get their turn. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Earlier this week, Kansas City Mayor Sly James touted his plan for an expanded pre-K education program. His plan is to fund it with a 3/8-cent citywide sales tax, and he wanted to place it before voters this November. But then, this morning, the mayor called a press conference and announced he'll delay his proposal. He said this, "Unfortunately, this conversation about pre-K has been more about the agendas of adults than the needs of our children. So rather than allowing the importance of child's education to get lost in an increasingly acrimonious political environment, we're going to step back and let the April voters hear this ballot issue." The April election will be his last one in office. School superintendents and other stakeholders have been saying not so fast, raising concerns about the regressive nature of the sales tax that would fund this program, the structure of the governing board that would oversee it, and the concern that the program could become a stepping stone for vouchers. With us to discuss these concerns and their response to the mayor's announcement this morning are Dr. Mark Bedell. He's the superintendent of the Kansas City School District. Mark, nice to have you. Welcome back.
Thank you, Steve. Appreciate you having us.
Gwen Grant is the president and CEO of the Urban League of Greater Kansas City. Gwen, it's always nice to have you.
Thank you, Steve.
Dr. Dan Clemens is here. He's the superintendent of the North Kansas City School District. Dr. Clemens, welcome.
Thank you.
Well, Superintendent Bedell, let me begin with you here. The mayor said today he wants to delay the vote on this from November to April. Your reaction?
I mean, we're thankful. We're happy that the mayor has decided to listen to us. And one of the things we wanted to do was to ensure that we took a true collaborative process in coming together as a community, very similar to the approach that I know I took 2 years ago when we built our strategic plan. We had a tremendous amount of stakeholders that were a part of that. And because of that inclusion, that has resulted in us, in my opinion, us being able to really move this district with some sense of alignment and intentionality. And we just felt that there were components of engagement with the community at large that needed to be addressed that hadn't been addressed. And but we do thank the mayor, and we also want our community to know that every single one of us that's in here today, we value early childhood education. That's a big deal. It's a part of our strategic plans. We're actually doing a lot of work in that area, but we want to make sure that we're very intentional around what this plan looks like and what the accountability structure will look like.
And so slowing down is a good thing as far as you're concerned?
Absolutely, yes, sir.
And Gwen Grant from the Urban League, you're nodding your head as I said that. You think it's a good thing, too?
Oh, absolutely, I think it's a good thing. I think we all support expanded pre-K. And so the agenda for the Urban League, the agenda for the superintendents, and the agenda for the adults that I'm collaborating with is early pre-K expansion. So to ask for a delay is simply to ensure that we do the best job possible to make sure that children have equitable access to pre-K, that the governance system is functioning appropriately, that school superintendents and school administrators who are trained and prepared to and responsible and accountable for educating our children have control in that process.
You're suggesting that going forward, then, this plan needs to be tinkered with, Gwen? Am I hearing that?
Yes, the plan needs to be improved. We've outlined several areas of concern, and we need time to address them. We need time to broaden the conversation. There are some things in this plan that work. There are many things in this plan that do not work. But have we truly exhausted all of our options? Have we explored every funding mechanism strategy that could come into play here? And I'm not sure we have.
Dr. Dan Clemens, again, superintendent of the North Kansas City School District. What's your reaction to this news today that the mayor is slowing down a bit?
Well, it excites us. We always like to come to the table and collaborate and make the best decision for kids. When we understood that there was about $300 million that would be spent over 10 years on early childhood, I think the adults have to get involved to make sure the plan's solid.
You know, there's no question here that the mayor, Dan, has put this issue four square in front of the voters. Is that a good thing? Pre-K education being now at the top of the city's agenda?
We're excited that preschool expansion could happen in all of our school districts because we know how critically important it is. Preschool is something that we've talked about with our own Board of Education. Our state's now increasing funds for early childhood education, which is exciting for us. For us, it's about the details of the plan to make sure that we meet the needs of all students. North Kansas City has 11 municipalities within our school boundaries. This would only impact the students of the city of Kansas City.
Mm-hmm.
So we want to make sure that we have a detailed plan that supports all students.
So no question then, you all support pre-K. It's the details of this plan that you're all nodding your heads that need to be tinkered with here. Let me get our listeners involved here early on. 816-235-2888. Do you support pre-K education in Kansas City? Do you favor a slowdown at this point in terms of implementing what Mayor James wants to implement? 816-235-2888 or tweet us at KCUR up to date. Gwen.
So basically, I think a critical factor here is understanding that the city is trying to put pre-K, an education initiative, into an economic development funding mechanism. So that's the challenge.
Explain that to me.
Because the pre-K sales tax is by state statute would be funded through an economic development system.
The
right?
sales tax
the
that
sales
mayor,
tax.
Mayor has
right.
proposed.
Right.
Here.
So that structure is there, or by statute, it makes it very difficult to arrive at the level of flexibility that is necessary to address the needs of each of the school districts in this plan.
Yeah, Mark?
Yeah, and I definitely agree with that.
Take your finger off that button. That's the wrong button to be
sorry,
pushing. But yeah, now you're back.
Button.
Yeah, go ahead.
But I 100% agree with Gwen's statement here. There is a statute, 171.011, which really, from a state level, allows for districts to have local control. That local control is given to those elected members who serve on the Board of Education. And so the school board ultimately is responsible for making the rules and regulations of the organization, and making sure that there is true governance from the community, elected by the community for that particular purpose.
So, Superintendent Clemens, one of the concerns expressed here is that you guys weren't controlling this program. You're the educators here, and the program was going to be managed by people outside the educational orbit. Do I have that right?
Absolutely, Steve. And to agree with Dr. Bedell, there's a governance issue. But there's also another issue that we've been trying to work through, and we're getting different opinions from different legal sources, and that's around Statute 67-1305, whether you can commingle economic development dollars with state dollars to support this type of education. So that's one of the biggest questions we have. If it was passed, would we even be able to receive some of the funds to support early childhood?
So one big issue then is use of the sales tax to fund pre-K education. The mayor had proposed a 3.8-cent tax increase. Gwen Grant, if that's not the way to go, what is the way to go? What's a path forward here?
Well, I think several alternatives need to be explored. I believe in the Kansas City Star editorial earlier this week spoke of the working with the governor. We have a new governor who is certainly much more reasonable and collaborative to explore opportunities for state funding to support the expansion of pre-K.
Mm-hmm.
That's one alternative. I think we don't know all of the answers, but we certainly feel that we as a community, as a collaborative, authentically engaged community, can arrive at some solutions that are much more appropriate for this initiative.
So it could be a property tax.
Well, the ideal, so a sales tax is regressive. A property tax, a levy, is progressive.
Mm-hmm.
And so we certainly would be much more supportive of a levy as an alternative than a sales tax.
I just want to point out that just a year ago, there was a big push to pass a 1/8 cent sales tax to improve the East Side. You were all for that.
Absolutely. We played a role in supporting that, and it was successful. But it was an economic development tax to do economic development, not education.
Okay.
It was the appropriate mechanism to address the needs of our community.
So, Mark Bedell, do you think Mayor James tabled this because of your concerns and others about improvements needed in the plan?
I would say yes. I think he had an opportunity. He and I talked, and we've been talking over months, just because I do meet with him once a month, and I've expressed my concerns with the proposal. That's, you know, it's a noble idea. I think it's something that is definitely needed. But the details within the proposal was an area that really concerned us. And as you think about our organization, the cooperating school districts, one of the things that's pretty much a non-negotiable with this group is anything that looks like a voucher, anything mm-hmm. that really proposes that money will follow kids, and in particular to parochial schools, private schools. Those are the type of things that all of us have put on our legislative agenda to fight against. And so while people say it's not a voucher, I mean, my attitude is if money follows a kid and money follows a kid, even though it's not state money, it's local taxes, money follows kids to a parochial school, that's a major concern that we have in the public entity in terms of the work that we're trying to do to service children in our community.
And how do you get around, I was going to ask in this conversation about the concerns over vouchers, how do you move around that concern, Dr. Bedell? How does that happen?
Well, I just think that as we sit down and we begin to have this dialogue, there are funding structure opportunities where you ultimately want to let the schools kind of have that control, because every district's different. In North Kansas City, they do not live through the type of world that I live through. So they want to be able to have control, and their money needs to stay within that district. In my world, I work with private providers. I work with charters. And at the end of the day, money does follow kids in my world. But that's not relevant for the other 14 school districts. So we have to sit down and really talk through what the plan looks like and how it could work across the board.
Gwen?
I think a plan needs to be developed that funds districts separately. Mm-hmm. You know, so how do you fund each district to expand pre-K within their district?
So each district, are you saying, Gwen Grant, should have its own funding
model? There needs to be a funding model that allows districts, so as opposed to putting the funding in the system that follows the kid,
right?
You expand the number of slots that each school district can provide for children who live within the district boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
So if you say, Casey, constitutes the Kansas City Public Schools District, then a certain amount of funding would be allocated for that to fund X number of seats, and then they would apply for funding to expand seats in their district. Charter schools could apply for funds to expand seats in their schools. I think there's an equitable way to get to that, but each education entity maintains the control over the education process.
We're talking about pre-K funding in Kansas City. Mayor Sly James just this morning announcing he's backing off a plan to push for a 3/8 cent citywide sales tax on the November ballot. He wants to see it in April. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here, or tweet us at KCUR up to date. I want to go to some phone calls here in just a moment, but Superintendent Clemens, just maybe we need to back off and go for some context here. Under any scenario that's now being talked about, will any scenario satisfy all the need there is for pre-K education in the Kansas City metro, or are there still going to be needs going forward even after this new plan is implemented?
Well, I think certainly Our goal would be provide early childhood education to every student within our school district.
Are you confident you can get that with this set of proposals that are being looked at now?
I'm confident we will get there at some point. It's going to take time. We add additional slots each year. If we have additional resources in which the state is going to provide to us, we'll continue to grow our program.
Okay. Let me go to some phone calls again. 816-235-2888. Kim from Overland Park. Kim, welcome to Up to Date.
Hi, thank you. I'm just calling to see, I don't know as much going on in Jeff City with accreditation as I do in Kansas, but Kansas just passed the 5 core standards, and one of those is early education, acknowledging that the brain is 90% developed by age 5, which I know you guys are all in agreement with. But one of the caveats in Kansas now is every elementary school is going to have a pre-K program in order to get accredited. Is there anything like that on the books in Missouri in regard to that? Because we're getting forced to do that, in my opinion, a good way, because I admit that's where my area of expertise is early ed. So I was just curious to know the history of what's kind of going on in Missouri. I know you have a new governor coming and whatnot.
Yeah, Kim, thank you. Will Missouri require that every school district have a pre-K plan to be accredited, Mark?
Yeah, I will tell you at this point that is part of the conversation that we are going to have. It's a big part of our legislative agenda, not only as the Kansas City Public School District, but the Cooperating School District Superintendent's Forum around really figuring out how do we communicate with our legislators to create a model that will allow for universal early childhood. Right now, we are not there, but we're very hopeful, as Gwen said, with the new governor who seems to be more willing to talk to us and actually seems to be pretty partial towards wanting to see early childhood expansion become a part of the budget in the future.
Superintendent Clemens, just to summarize here then, there have been concerns expressed this morning about the way this program is being funded through the sales tax. There have been concerns expressed about the need for more local governance, giving educators more control over this program. Are those all the major concerns, or is there anything else that we should discuss this morning?
The voucher's a big one for
the voucher,
us.
We've
talked about that a little bit.
Making sure that's not here as well.
Yeah, and then beyond that, it's really about sitting down at the table and coming up with a plan that's best for all kids.
How confident are you that the mayor's willing to have that conversation now?
I'm confident.
Yeah.
I believe at the end of the day, we're all going to do what's best for kids.
Gwen Graham.
Yeah, there's one other opportunity to support public schools in how they would fund pre-K, and one is economic development reform at City Hall, with how the city is advancing and utilizing economic development and actually taking revenues away from the school district, the library, and mental health. And if they could retain that money, then they would have more resources at their disposal.
This is tax increment financing, giving developers tax breaks that have cost school districts
a
lot of money.
If city council would address economic development reform strategies, then that's another opportunity to increase cash flow.
Let's turn the conversation just for a moment, Superintendent Bedell. How does pre-K education change the game going forward for students in your school district? I mean, is it realistic to think that a robust program ultimately someday, 20 years down the road, could help reduce crime in Kansas City? Is there a connection there? Can you help us understand why people should be engaged in this conversation?
This is very critical to the lifeline of this city. I've worked in other school systems where early childhood was a priority, and as a result, those school systems were school systems that were awarded Broad Prize because of how they performed. But you start with these kids being educated at the age of 3 and 4, and I said this when I interviewed 2.5 years ago, that if it was up to me, we'd start educating kids at the age of 2. But my first press conference as a superintendent was to do a press conference around the district providing 1,100 tuition-free early childhood seats my first day here, July 1 of 2016.
So the model is still wonky as far as you're concerned. We're not educating kids early enough.
We need to educate them early.
Even earlier than age 4.
In a situation where you're performing triage in kindergarten. I mean, if you want to put kids on a rigorous track where they're going to be able to take advanced placement, pre-AP courses, be successful with IB, then the rigor starts with them being at or above grade level when they enter into kindergarten. And we know that early childhood does that. It allows for the kids, and we see it in our data. The kids who have been exposed to early childhood, they come in, they have a better phonemic awareness, they have a much stronger understanding of colors, how to count, they're still being able to understand the alphabet and pronouncing those letters at that age. But
I'm still struggling with some of those skills myself, so be gentle here. Okay. if you would. Yeah.
But I think it does better support us in being able to build a much stronger student because now they're at grade level, they're at state standard level.
If that's the case, Dr. Bedell, why isn't this conversation all about starting pre-K at age 3 instead of age 4? Why not change this conversation given this pause we're taking right now?
But that's what this will allow for us to do. Mm-hmm. I think that's part of
this pause
is bringing everybody in and saying, hey, we also have 3-year-olds. We actually service 3-year-olds in our school district right now in our early childhood program. And so we want to make sure that this plan will allow for us to have that type of dialogue and to ultimately as a community come together and say, this is what makes the most sense. This is where we're going to get our biggest return on this investment from our taxpayers or whatever entity we go after from a funding mechanism.
Dr. Clemens, what is the correlation between pre-K education and higher test scores among your students going forward? What have you seen?
Well, absolutely.
What do you suspect?
Absolutely. We like take a lot. We take a look at the data around third grade reading scores. And we know that if our students aren't reading at grade level of third grade, we have to do some significant intervention. Early childhood is critically important at that level. But I'll also tell you that in some of our schools that have high mobility where we see large numbers of students not being exposed to early childhood, we go ahead and extend those to year-round schools to try to catch them up. Which is expensive to the taxpayers, but North Kansas City, that's been something that we've implemented to try to support all kids.
Mm-hmm. So, Gwen Grant, this pause we're taking here allows this conversation to perhaps expand.
Yes.
Am I hearing that right from you all?
Absolutely. And we are going to expand the conversation through a community collaborative for the expansion of pre-K. Mm-hmm. And so we'll have more to say about that community collaborative going forward, but we are committed to hanging in, doing the hard work to find the solutions and find the appropriate funding mechanisms.
Dr. Clemens, how do voters who are looking at something like this, how can they be assured that there is some oversight, there's some accountability here in terms of they will see progress in students that might result from pre-K education? Assessment, I guess, is the word that's often used in education circles. What kind of assessment will take place with a program like this?
Are you talking about the sales tax?
About the pre-K portion. Are our kids learning at a rate that we would expect them to learn if this program is implemented?
Yeah, certainly. We had the same question about the proposal that the mayor gave us. What are going to be the assessments that are involved? We do have a set of assessments. We have an early childhood coordinator. We do assess our kids. And what we know is that they are kindergarten ready when they get there. And more so, about 80% of our students are reading at grade level by third grade in North Kansas City. The portion that aren't, a lot of them haven't had the early childhood experiences. So we provide additional interventions for those students to get them there.
Dr. Bedell, it sounds like there's a whole lot of conversation that now needs to commence. How is that going to happen?
Well, I think it's pretty simple. I have shared with individuals that the plan that's currently being proposed, it's a well-intentioned plan, right? It's about policy, but I've also been very clear that we need to make sure that the questions that need to be addressed are being addressed, that the appropriate right players are collaborating at the table in order for this to become an initiative that we can all embrace. And what I talk to people about is our job is we want to make sure that as policymakers, we craft policy that ultimately will enshrine the will of what our community is asking for. And that's very critical. We think that pre-K expansion is a public discussion that is absolutely worth having, especially among a group of people who all want positive outcomes for kids. And this is the thing I've said to my board and even to my community. Urgency without strategy is chaos, period. Policy and process matters. And we want to make sure that we really do look at the process and that we do this the right way, because in my experience, there's been a lot of things that have been done in Kansas City without, to me, the proper collaboration, and we don't necessarily get the end results. And I don't think anybody wants that. I don't think the mayor wants that. I don't think our community wants it. I know I don't want it as an educator.
Yeah.
That's where we want to go with this.
Just a final point from Patty, who's tweeted us this. Keep in mind, universal pre-K is always going to be hard to achieve, given that it takes resources to develop a well-prepared pre-K workforce. We have to acknowledge that pre-K teachers are particularly underpaid for this very important work. Something to keep in mind going forward.
Absolutely.
Okay. I want to thank our good guests for this good conversation on this day of breaking news about the mayor's pre-K education proposal. It's been pushed back. A public vote has been pushed back until perhaps April. That was the news coming out of City Hall today. I want to thank Dr. Mark Bedell. He's superintendent of the Kansas City, Missouri School District. Gwen Grant, president and CEO of the Urban League. And Dr. Dan Clemens, superintendent of the North Kansas City School District. Thank you all for a good conversation. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk about Charlie Parker and the glorious history of jazz right here in Kansas City. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday, we learned about the Kansas City Social Investment Pool and how it aims to turn derelict homes into affordable housing. You can hear more. Just go to kcur.org/uptodate. Monday, we see how The Mission Continues is doing as the nonprofit emerges from the shadow of scandal involving its founder and former Missouri Governor Eric Greitens. That's Monday on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, Charlie Parker would have turned 98 this month had he lived a long life, but the great revolutionary from Kansas City who changed jazz for all time lived only to age 34, thanks to a whole lot of hard living. This week, and running through the 25th, Kansas City is once again commemorating the legacy of a man who still evokes awe in jazz lovers all over the world. Now, a conversation about a special jazz history tour taking place on Saturday, August 25th. That's a week from Saturday, and Kansas City's new designation as a creative city of music in America. With us to talk about it, UMKC Associate Professor of Urban Planning and Design, Jake Wagner, who helped Kansas City earn the only UNESCO Creative City of Music in America designation, mainly through his compelling presentation. Jake, nice to have you back. Welcome.
Good morning, Steve. Thanks.
Christopher Burnett is also here. He's the COO and founder of the Artists Recording Collective record label, and he knows a lot about Kansas City's rich jazz history. Christopher, welcome to you, too.
Good morning, Steve.
Well, Jake, Kansas City is the only UNESCO Creative City of Music in America designee. UNESCO is the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, and it seeks to build peace through international cooperation in education, the sciences, and culture. How big a deal is this?
It's huge. It's huge. Kansas City's jazz history laid the foundation for this designation and application. We applied last year. We got the designation. Anita Dixon was the lead author on the application. Of course, she knew Eddie Baker back in the day, the founder of the Charlie Parker Memorial Foundation. So this builds on decades of recognizing Kansas City's jazz history as having an international impact.
What does this get us?
What this gets us is recognition and friendships from 180 cities around the world. Myself, Anita Dixon, and Mayor Pro Tem Scott Wagner all went to the annual conference this past June in Poland. We went to Krakow and Katowice, city of literature and a city of music. But as the only city of music in the United States, we have the gift to represent all of the music in the United States. So really reaching out to other music cities. But what it does is, you know, it reminds people in Kansas City that the world knows about our music, and Charlie Parker is front and central in that history.
Are we going to see more programs here? Are we going to see more visitors from out of town, Jake? How do you see it?
Absolutely. We're working with a number of partners who helped us earn the designation. You know, we have a great jazz scene in Kansas City, but we have an amazing music scene overall. We've invested in the arts over the last 30 years. We've seen a lot of progress. We have a huge concentration of design firms, engineering. All those things come together to really say we are a creative city. Now we have the opportunity to say, what about our jazz heritage? We're celebrating almost 100 years of Charlie Parker. What about Ben Webster and these other musicians? Let's make sure the next generation can carry that forward.
And this was a priority for you, Jake. Why?
10 years ago, I began my work with neighborhoods in Kansas City, looking at neighborhoods on the what we call the East Side, the Prospect Corridor,
right,
and looking at really what I thought was a missing ingredient, which was culture and creativity in music. And so I began to look at, well, where did the members of the Local 627 Jazz Union, the African American Union that laid the foundation for Parker, where do they live? And we started to identify with Anita, with other local historians, Joe Lewis Maddox. We started to look at where did the jazz musicians live and where were their houses and which houses were actually still left. And so to think about, you know, we have this opportunity to drive cultural tourism to the neighborhoods and to have urban neighborhoods be a place where culture and creativity can be part of the neighborhood revitalization process.
Now, one more question that I want to bring Christopher into our conversation. Why was Kansas City the only city, Jake, to get this designation?
Because we applied, Steve. We were the first applicants. We put together a great application. Anita Dixon led that process. She was able to get the support of Mayor Pro Tem Scott Wagner and Mayor James's support to make the application. Mayor James signed off on it, and we made a compelling case. And the world knows. The research that we had done showed that Kansas City musicians traveled all over the world after the 1920s and 30s. They took jazz to London. They took jazz to Paris. And you see the distribution of jazz. And Ben Webster ends up in Copenhagen. Mm-hmm. And now the Ben Webster Foundation's in Copenhagen. So Kansas City musicians, including but not limited to Charlie Parker, have had an international impact, and the world is aware of that.
Christopher, I think it goes without saying, anything that can be done to bolster the Kansas City jazz scene is worth doing.
Exactly. And this initiative, the Charlie Parker Celebration, charlieparkercelebration.com has all the information, that was spearheaded by a group called KC Jazz Alive several years ago,
yes,
has turned into what in essence is a festival for the city that celebrates all the various venues. We bring in significant artists. This year we've got a Grammy Award-winning saxophone player, Tavon Pinnicott, who is one of the
I've heard him.
Artists.
And he's worth hearing.
He is a monster. He's a very great player. And our own Lonnie McFadden, Mr. Kansas City, they're co-artists in residence. And the kickoff's tonight with Lonnie at the Phoenix.
Now, Christopher, there's something amazing about this, that 63 years after Charlie Parker's passing, we're still talking about him today. I think, is it fair to say his legacy worldwide hasn't waned?
Well, musically, the significance of Charlie Parker musically is the cause of that. He revolutionized the harmony of jazz music. He developed a language, he and Dizzy Gillespie and Thelonious Monk, that group in New York. Charlie Parker was the voice of that, the harmonic voice of that. And today, we still base what we play off of what he came up with.
Mm-hmm. You
know? He took the blues and changed the whole blues. Everything he plays is a blues, literally.
Mm-hmm.
But he added substitutions beyond the three chords.
You can't help but wonder, what would Charlie think about the fact that even today, 63 years later, we're still honoring Charlie? Because his early years here, he wasn't exactly embraced with open arms when it came to his jazz playing. The famous story about him trying to engage in a jam session and Joe Jones or someone throwing the cymbal. And
he was getting it together during that time.
Getting him kicked off the stage because he didn't have it yet.
And he was also 16 years old.
He was 16 years old.
You know? He was still getting that language together. He was still figuring things out, and I heard an interview, I think that Paul Desmond did of him, and he did very few interviews. You probably heard that as well. It's on YouTube.
Yeah. Yes.
And him talking about, he was very humble, it sounded like, about his contributions to the music. He would say, well, I'm trying to make beautiful music, and hopefully somebody will come along and do something with it.
Mm-hmm.
And that really has happened in a lot of ways. I looked at him as a visionary. Charlie Parker was like my parents' age. He was of that generation, and they really liked his music because it was very progressive. But I look at him as a visionary musically because he played with strings. One of mm-hmm. my favorite albums is that album with strings.
Charlie Parker with strings.
It's just gorgeous arrangements. Yeah. Mitch Miller and those guys put that together.
There's a story that Charlie Parker met Dizzy Gillespie right here in Kansas City at the Mutual Musicians Foundation. Is that story true?
You know something.
I've wondered about that for years.
Steve, when I came back, the great Ahmed Al-Adin.
Yes.
I
former great jazz sax player and educator. Yeah.
Exactly. I came back and I wanted to learn about jazz. I completed an Army career. I was 45 years old. So I wanted to connect with someone who could teach me the history. I'm from this area, but I wanted to know the history. And I asked him about that, and he really wasn't sure. He said, I've heard that so many times, Chris, but I don't really know. I mean, I don't know that for a fact. And if he says he didn't know it for a fact, I have to say, well, I can't really say it is.
Well, I prefer to believe it's true, because if those two met here and those two together changed the music and brought in bebop, what a great moment it is for Kansas City.
He did tell me that Miles Davis came through here, and he actually was a young kid who went to Miles' hotel room and knocked on the door and met Miles.
Well, this year, as in past years, there's a tour of prominent jazz sites in Kansas City that'll take part with the Charlie Parker celebration that's launching here. And that's our subject here, if you're just joining our conversation. I want to ask you about some of these sites, Christopher, and one of them is the Historic Bowl at 12th Street and Vine. Tell us about the Historic Bowl. What is that?
Well, from what I understand about that, it was a site that people would gather around. There were concerts, there were things that would happen there.
And musicians
would gather there. It was like a jam session, or it was by invite, you know, mm-hmm. all of the great players, they would have sessions there and learn, and people would listen to them. It was very communal, if you will. Al-Adin told me the story of they would just go out there in the evenings and just listen to music and stay until the wee hours of morning as little kids just listening to what was going on.
Jake, why don't we have more of that sort of street playing in town? That would be, it strikes me, as a really good thing to bring to the neighborhoods, and people would love that, I would think.
Absolutely. I think, you know, when you've had 50 years or more of suburban sprawl and you've seen a decline in population density, you know, people back in the day would use the parks and boulevards as their air conditioning units. You know, they get out of their houses and chill out outside. And I think the other thing that when you think about 18th and Vine and from 1920 to 1935, that was a period when, you know, Charlie Parker would have been growing up in KCK and then moved to KC Mo. But it was really the black metropolis. It was a moment of industrial growth. There were a lot of activity, even with the Depression. There was this growth of population and industrialization, and you had a city within a city. You had high school music programs. You had drum lines and this whole tradition of marching bands. And so if you look at the historical photos of that era, people were, they had very formal parades here in Kansas City. And so, you know, it was a different culture in terms of people's relationship to public mm-hmm. space. When you're living at a higher density, you know, the parks become your living room. And that's different than today, where we turn on the air conditioning, you know, turn on the TV and zone out. So I think it's part of that. But I think also it's about rebuilding 18th and Vine as a destination for the entire region, where that becomes a place where you can go down at any time of day and something's happening.
And that's still very much a work in progress, isn't it, Jake?
Yes, sir. I was just down there yesterday. You know, the city architect, Eric Bosch, has made a ton of progress. They're now stabilizing buildings that have been neglected for decades. So we're seeing the shift. The sea tide has happened. We need to keep moving that in the right direction. And there's a number of exciting projects happening in and around the district that I think will be a critical mass for that kind of change.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about the Charlie Parker Celebration and a jazz history tour that'll be taking place a week from Saturday. We were talking, Christopher, about the bowl, the historic bowl at 12th Street and Vine. There's an outdoor exhibit there that I don't think I've ever seen before, that maybe a lot of people haven't seen before.
There is, and I think the significance of all of this, having the tour centered around that, if you will, there are two phases to this tour. There's a phase one and a phase two. In between the phases, there is the traditional Charlie Parker salute, a salute to Bird, they call it. It's going to be led by Professor Dan Thomas, and it's going to be a concert. They're going to have food. It's going to be a really great thing, and there are going to be pop-up exhibits in the area. And that's an effort to bring people, contemporary citizens, closer to the history that you're talking about of that area.
Yeah.
Because there are a lot of people that aren't even aware of the significance of it in that context.
Where else are we going to go as part of this tour? I see a list here, the home of J. Hootie McShann. That would be interesting. The home of Count Basie. I'd like to see that myself.
Yes.
What else would you point to, Christopher, that would be places that are worth talking
Hotlips
about?
Warren Hotlips Page, the trumpeter.
Yes.
Warren Hotlips Page. And he, to me, he's always been an interesting person in the history of jazz. One thing, because he lived until he was only 46, so he passed away early. He stayed in Kansas City, and he worked with Walter Page's group, the bass player. Walter Page and Hotlips were not related. They had the same last name. But Orrin Page went to New York, and that's where he passed away. But he was known as a great vocalist and a performer, and he's one of the people who musicians and audiences alike really respected and loved his music.
There's the Roseland Inn Beer Garden.
Now that one, I had to look that up, actually, because I was not aware of that at all. And I looked it up, and there are several venues like that that are on this tour. There's another one, the Jockey Club.
Right.
I had heard of like the Hey Hey Club and the Reno Club, of course. The Reno was like the big, you know,
yes,
the big fancy jazz club.
But the Reno Club's long gone,
yes,
long torn down, right?
And that's right. That's
Red
right.
And Dutch, there are things like that. And
where was the Reno Club, Jake? I mean,
it was on 12th Street.
Close to the police department, right?
That's right, yeah.
Right behind it, I think?
There's a whole lot of nice parking lots that used to be famous jazz clubs in Kansas City.
I think I used to park my car when I reported to
go.
Work to cover
yeah,
the police department
right,
for the
right.
newspaper back in the day.
Right, exactly.
And that's right, yeah, right
yeah,
behind.
Yeah, so 12th Street was very important. And, you know, it was a direct line from the African-American community along Paseo, 12th and Vine, Paseo area, directly into downtown. And what you see is the area that we now sort of call the east side of the crossroads, really from all the way up at 9th and Paseo down to 18th and Paseo. The whole area was African-American back in the day, you know. And so a lot of that was then later impacted by urban renewal, by highways and things like that. But 12th Street would have been the place where there were a lot of sort of society clubs and places that, you know, musicians would have gone to play, but they would have hung out. If you read about Count Basie, he said they would hang out really at 18th and Vine, and in the African-American community, you know, that's where they hung out, even though they would go play at white clubs. What's amazing about Local 627, and I think, you know, we have to remember this was a time when everyone was extremely organized. There were unions, there were, you know, the the professionals living in the community. Yes. They laid the foundation. They controlled a lot of venues, white and African-American venues throughout the city and not limited to the district. So they had a really important influence because they were organized and unionized. And mm-hmm. that's a missing ingredient today.
If 12th and Vine is the location immortalized in the song Kansas City, how did 18th and Vine become sort of the focal point for jazz today?
18th and Vine, one of the reasons why, it's sort of a two pieces to that. One piece is the loss of 12th and Vine and how much demolition there was and the loss of those clubs.
Anybody fight that back in the day?
You know, I talked to Joe Louis Maddox. He was one of the guys who had the keys, you know, of some of the most famous clubs before they were demolished. You know, he worked for Urban Renewal. And so, you know, that was a big loss. But, you know, at 18th and Vine, you had the business class. You had, you know, all the businesses.
Matt
but you
Laws.
Also had, yeah, you had Matt Laws at the Lincoln Building on the first floor, which is a famous clothing store. You had some clubs down there. You had the Street Hotel. You know, so it was really the city within a city, the black metropolis, if you will. And because of the Union Hall, because of 627, they really defended the whole area and the district from more urban renewal.
Okay, let me go to some phone calls here. Let's go to Greg from Kansas City, Missouri. Gentlemen, if you put on your headphones, you could hear what Greg has to say to us here. Okay. Greg, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. How you doing?
I'm well, thanks. This is Greg Carroll, right?
This is Greg Carroll.
Welcome, Greg.
Thank you. It's good to be on and listen to the great interview that you're doing, both this one and the one preceding, Steve. Great work.
I appreciate it, Greg. Always do.
So yeah, I wanted to just first thank Chris and Jacob. They're being a little shy in terms of their role. They're going to serve a very pivotal role as our tour guides for that tour. But the tour itself is huge, as Chris has alluded to, with not only the walking tour and the riding bus tour, but a lunch given to all of the attendees, a recognition of many of the family members that represent some of the artists in the 16 different pop-up banners that will be part of its Kansas City Jazz Legacy display, which is brand new. I'm literally unpacking them as we speak. We're going to do, you know, the Bowl was a great place where the artists mostly hung. That's going to be a great celebratory place. In addition to that, and I really appreciate Chris's and Jacob's perspective on this, I think this is a great opportunity to do really a call to action for the city of Kansas City to really step up and support its jazz musicians, its jazz venues, its educators, its students, so that we can really fit the bill that has been designated us by UNESCO. By really supporting the music, doing more than just saying we're a jazz and barbecue town, but going out and supporting, paying for artists, paying for the food and drink, and really being a good commerce folk in terms of helping to support the music.
Greg, so, if people want to connect with this tour, how can they do it? Remind people.
Yeah, they can go on to charlieparkercelebration.com, and when they click on that, click on the full schedule. There's 28 events. Click on any of the title. It'll take you right to Eventbrite, which has a full description of the event. They can learn who the people are. There's bios there. And then they click and buy their tickets. And many of our events, Steve, are free and open to the public. So we really want a call to action for people to come out. This is the largest celebration of its kind, and we're moving into planning the 100th anniversary.
That's Greg Carroll, former head of the Jazz Museum here in town. Greg, thanks very much. I want to thank Christopher Burnett, COO and founder of the Artist Recording Collective record label, for your time. Christopher, thank you.
Thank you, Steve. Thanks.
And Jake Wagner, an associate professor of urban planning and design over at UMKC. Thanks for helping us get that UNESCO designation. That's great.
You're welcome. Thanks, Steve.
And we're listening to Charlie Parker right now, his track, Easy to Love. On Monday, if you want to be socially responsible, a social responsible investor, the Smart Money Experts has some tips for you. Tune in for that. Our theme music typically is, you normally hear at this time, is composed by the great Bobby Watson. We had help this week from Linda Scher, Chris Brewitt, Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, and Kathleen Pointer. I'm Steve Kraske. Have a great weekend, all, and you are up to date.